Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
All right. Back in the studio. First podcast of 2020. Excited, Reg? Sure you are. Look at you. Christening the new year with yet another delicious sub sandwich. Just wondering, if we taped this podcast either earlier in the day or later in the day, would you still be eating a submarine sandwich? Or is it just because we do it around lunchtime? You're nodding. I don't know what that means. Okay, whatever. Put the sub down. Check the... Oh, you can do both, right? Okay, yeah. You just mouthed that to me. I can do both. Okay. Then check the levels. The needles are bouncing. They look good. Levels are good in here. Mic is hot. Talent is hotter. put it down in the books. Show 189 as we make our way toward 200 here. Here we go. Let's start 2020 off with on a rocking foot here, huh? Okay, ready? Let's do this thing. Three S's, star, smile, strong. Here we go. Ready? 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted here at WGNplus.com, or it is also available wherever you download your favorite podcasts. On those formats, don't forget to subscribe and rate, and most of all, don't forget to tell your friends. Your endorsement and your word of mouth goes a long way, and your devotion and loyalty to this podcast on a weekly basis is certainly appreciated as we enter going on our fourth year. In May of this year, we will hit the four-year mark. And I would assume sometime in the next couple of months, we will be hitting podcast number 200. Don't forget, also, go on our landing page. If you like what you hear, you go to the entertainment section on WGNplus.com and you go to the Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic prompt, where you will find all previous 189 episodes. Oh no, I'm sorry, 188. Don't get ahead of yourself there. Which can only mean one thing. Now I'll say it. You welcome to 189. Yes, as we gallop our way toward episode 200, I would assume 4 weeks, 2 months, another three, so maybe 2.5 months. So you figure January, February, middle of March sometime we should hit 200. And as I said, in May, I believe it was like May 17th or so in 2016, I should go back to my day planner from 2016. And look to see when the first episode was posted. I could do that because I have all my day planners from the last 10 years. And now I am in full swing. 2020 day planner is in full swing. I've already X'd many days off, and it's highlighted, and there's events. And 2020 is definitely on the way. What I wanted to talk about today... to you was the idea of what it means and what it should mean, more importantly, I believe, in being a fan or admirer of something. And certainly I think I am at least a little qualified to speak of this since, the name of this podcast, right, is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Right there in the title of this podcast, I am wearing my fandom on my sleeve. Obviously, my nickname of Elton Jim is a takeoff of Elton John because I'm a huge Elton John fan. And I don't know if a lot of people get the reference, understand the reference. I don't know if I've ever really talked about it before, but even the title of this podcast is a reference to Elton John. Elton John's, my favorite Elton John album is an album from 1975 called Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy, and basically is an autobiographical album about the story of Elton John and how he met Bernie Taupin and they started writing songs together. Elton John is Captain Fantastic and Bernie Taupin is the Brown Dirt Cowboy. And so I thought it would be kind of cool to have a subtle reference to the Elton John persona as well as an homage by calling the podcast Captain Podtastic, because hopefully it'll be a podtastic podcast. I'm coining my own word there, and I could be Captain Podtastic, whatever that means. So I am Captain Podtastic. And it's not, I mean, you know, if you listen to the podcast, you know, I mean, this is not solely about Elton John at all. I mean, I mention him in passing because of my interest and he you know, being a fan does play a part in my life. But this is not an Elton John centric podcast at all. But I thought to title it with some Elton John references, and Elton Jim is my nickname, would at least be kind of a subtle homage to my fandom as well as the persona that I am known in on the known as on the radio. So there you go. That's a freebie. That's a little cookie for you, if you will. A little podcast cookie. Little background into the meaning of the title of the podcast. But my point is, I certainly wear my fandom on my sleeve, and I've also worn it on my back. As far as I can remember, when I first became an Elton John fan, one of my signature things about back then, there wasn't internets and websites and all this other stuff, but I used to wear T-shirts, Elton John T-shirts all the time. I had about 30 of them at the high point of my fandom as a young kid. And, I didn't wear them to school because I went to a Catholic school, grammar school, and so we had to wear a uniform. But when I was in civilian clothes, in civvies, if you will, I always wore some kind of an Elton John T-shirt. Still have a lot of those originals as well. But my point is, I think that I have some credibility in this area because I am a fan of a lot of things. When I like something, I usually jump in head first, and you know it. Because I like to, wear my fandom, as I said, on my sleeve. If it's something that's important to me, I like to share it with as many people as possible. But there is an interesting dynamic that is going on in the world of fandom these days that I think is worth talking about and recognizing, because I believe it's going to play a bigger role, at least in the short term. But I believe, hopefully, I hope this trend goes away quickly, because I think it's doing some harm to the overall artistic vision and creative vision of our entertainment choices, especially compared to the way things were many years ago. You can't underestimate, as I've said many times, you cannot underestimate the power of the internet, it, and social media, which I think really at this point are hand in hand. It's been such a game changer, and we are still struggling and still trying to find a way to corral it and make it a part of our world without it being a dominant or detrimental phase of our culture and our world. And we've seen the internet be its good points and its bad points. It certainly connected the world. It certainly allowed people and information to be readily available. And that's a good thing. But we've seen the downside In many ways, we've seen it. There's accusations that the internet influenced our presidential election here in 2016. We've seen the internet, play a big role in bullying in kids, in grammar school and in high school and even in college. We've seen through, dating, internet, social media dating, we've seen, bad things happen, people getting assaulted or killed. So opening up that door has been, a plus and a minus. And we certainly celebrate the pluses, but we certainly are still struggling with a way to find a way to deal with the possible negative sides of that. And we are in a very transitional period in our culture as it is. And the internet has played a major role in that. I remember 5, 6, 7 years ago saying how the 60s and now in the, and the 2010s, that decade, were very similar. And even before that, once the smartphone, came into such popularity, it really changed everything because it put the power of a computer in somebody's back pocket or in their purse and gave you instant access, instant ability to comment, instant ability to show, your surroundings. And that's been good or bad. People have shown videos of things, of atrocities that we found out they didn't get the whole part, but that first image was defining. So there's a lot of problems with the internet. And sadly, those problems exist because when it first was introduced, the whole idea of it was this aspect of freedom and democracy, that everybody had a voice. And now, 25 or 20 years into it, we realize that that does have some serious and some harming consequences. And now we're playing catch up, trying to legislate and curtail many of the freedoms of the internet, because it started like Dodge City, no rules. And now as time goes on, we realize that, sadly, at the end of the day, there's a reason that we have laws, folks. Human beings need laws. We need to be, we need to have our behavior monitored, sadly, or curtailed, because if not, we will always take the easy way. We'll always take the selfish way, which often leads into crime. At the root of all crime is selfishness, right? Why does somebody rob someone? Because they want something. They're not thinking of the person they're taking it from. They're worried about themselves. Why does somebody assault someone? They're worried about their own needs or whatever psychological thing's going on. They're thinking about the other person. At the end of the day, crime is narcissism. It's selfishness. It's us putting our needs above anything else. And we allowed the internet to just go out there without any restrictions initially. And now we're having to play catch up. And the internet is really been the main driver, but it's only one aspect. We're in a very, as I said before, transitional, kind of tumultuous era right now. There's a lot of factors going on. And it's very similar to the 60s. And I don't even know what this has to do with being a fan, but I'll go into it anyway. Right? I've got an hour. our current period right now in the 60s, very similar. That 60s, an era of conflict and transition and tumult, as we had a generation gaps, knocking horns. We had a divisive country politically. We had a divisive country against the president, very divisive, between Nixon and Democrats. They hated Nixon. We had a war. We had movements for civil rights, which were dividing the country, especially in the South. We had women's lib expanding and growing, which was a complete shake and seismic move from the traditional male-female relationship and the roles that each played, that we're still, and now we're in a period of female female empowerment, and that's quite a different era than it was, 50, 60 years ago. So a lot of similar aspects, and that was a very, as I said, tumultuous time, and it didn't resolve itself overnight, maybe never has resolved itself fully. And now, but all that took place without the internet, without a 24-hour pipe that allowed people to access information, to post information, to be gossipy, to share their opinions, their conspiracy theories, their own paranoias. The internet is, as I said, a great tool when used correctly, and a scary one when not used correctly. And it elevates everything around it because of its urgency, because of its immediacy and its openness. Everybody or anybody can get on and say something. And there's a lot of followers out there. And as soon as somebody says something, all of a sudden there's these mini groups that form. And so we are in a tumultuous time, and I'm saying, and the internet, just elevates that, which gets to my point about what it's about the heart of what's going on in terms of being a fan. See, I always get back to the original, the original point. The internet has allowed fans to connect all over the globe, and it's also allowed fans to state their opinions on things around the globe. Now, we've always had the power to do that, but it was much, much less available to everyone. You may have told it to your friends, but now your friends could be all over the world and be the world. So the water cooler has grown quite a bit with the water cooler chat and gossip. And basically, we become one big water cooler where people go every day and gossip and talk about things, right? That's basically what the internet's become. It's become a giant water cooler. And Google water cooler, if you don't know what that is. But being a fan, because of the internet, has changed. It's given fans a new power that I believe is very dangerous to the creative process and to the artist, him or herself. And I say that because in the wake of, it's really come to light in the past year, in 2019. Earlier in the year, and it's really come because of two finales based in the entertainment world, two major consuming, obsessed about, entertainment entities came to an end in 2019. The first one in the first part of the year was the HBO series, TV series, Game of Thrones, which almost immediately from when it debuted became an overnight phenomenon, and people just lived and died by every episode, and they became consumed and obsessed, and this show became more than just a TV show. For many people, it became a part of their lives. These characters became friends of theirs almost. They were so invested in the show that episode after episode, there was immediate internet critiques, either positive or negative, by these diehard fans that were as I said before, obsessed with the show. And ultimately, when it ended, there was great controversy when the show ended. Many people did not like the ending. In fact, some fans via the internet were so displeased they were starting a petition and they wanted HBO to reshoot the ending the way they wanted it and have the show end in a way that was more serving the fans. And that's what I want to talk about. There's a new phrase now called fan service in the entertainment world, especially in television and in movies. Fan service, meaning that the creative process and the end result, the product, should serve the fans, should be what the fans want. Not necessarily what the creators want, not necessarily where the story may logically or illogically go, but where the fans want it to go. And in this era of high-priced entertainment projects, like a Star Wars movie that has to cost at least $150 to $200 million, or TV shows like Game of Thrones, which cost $2 or $3 million per episode, which is an outrageous sum in the TV world. Because the stakes are high in terms of the money being spent, the studios or the TV networks want to make sure that they are successful. And to hedge those bets, they are listening to all the cacophony out there, all the pros and cons and whatever may be the consensus out there, out on the internet, in these websites, and in these fan chat rooms and wherever, you know, fan input can be found. It's getting its way into the C-suite, into the CEO president suite, and it's trickling down the creative process to the creator of the story, him or herself. It's getting down to the screenwriter, to the playwright in a theatrical project, to the teleplay writer, the television writer. And it's influencing where the story goes. Those people that created it and are writing it, they may not want the story to go a certain way, but they're being pressured to do that. And this is nothing new. What's new is there's always been studio heads that say, we want a happy ending. And they have always been doing test runs of TV, especially in movies. And they'll show an early advanced screening and people will not like a certain ending and they'll change it. So this isn't new per se. But what is new is that this cumulative input now, because of the internet and the influence and the power that it has of social media to make and break things, it's really having major influence on the initial creation. You know, those test groups for the movies had an original ending and then they didn't like them. And so then they tinkered with it. But now, as it's being written, the fans' view, the fan service, has been implanted in the writers' minds to say, well, you got to get to this is where you have to get, because that's what the fans want. And that's disturbing to me, because I believe we are ruining the creative process. We are taking the power away from the writer, from the creator, from the creative vision of the person who came up with this idea to serve the fans. The fans, I think, are getting a much stronger role than they deserve or that they should have. Art is there to entertain and to challenge, but it's not there to serve. The role of the audience is to react and to accept or dismiss the art. It's not there to dictate what the art should be. That's what's scary. Would Da Vinci have put a big toothy smile on the Mona Lisa if someone had been over his shoulder saying, we really want the Mona Lisa to be a lot happier? I mean, if she's going to smile, Leonardo, then make her smile. No, that's what makes the Mona Lisa so enduring after this many centuries, is because of the mystery behind that smile. That was Leonardo's unique creative vision and his unique creative decision to give her that smile. There was no art by committee. There was no fan service in the Mona Lisa. And that's what I'm afraid of. Are we going to get moving forward because of the power of the internet and this new phenomenon of fan service that the diehard fans and the voice of the fans should dictate the way a movie or a TV show is made? No. It wasn't when it started. George Lucas, when he started Star Wars, didn't take a poll of the fans. He created his own movie, and they reacted to it and embraced it. But it was his vision. And that's what I'm afraid that this idea of fan service is going to impede. And it's gaining support and credibility because of the internet. I mentioned Star Wars because fan service not only was being bandied about a little during the conclusion of Game of Thrones this year, because people didn't like, you know, that Bran was named king, or what happened to Dany and she was killed, or what happened to Jon Snow. Everybody had their own ideas of how these beloved characters should end, and they had their own ideas of how the entire epical story should end, and it didn't end. Or those characters didn't have the endings that many of their most diehard fans wanted, and there was a rebellion. And the fans felt cheated. They said, my goodness, you know, we love these characters, and we want them to end this way. And so, when the Game of Thrones finale came, there was a lot of backlash. And toward the end of the year, we had another franchise coming to an end, the Star Wars saga of the Skywalkers, at least. There will be more Star Wars movies. But supposedly the saga of the Skywalker family, starting with Anakin Skywalker, who became Darth Vader, and then Luke Skywalker, and forward, has ended now with the recently released The Rise of Skywalker final episode, the ninth film in that franchise's official release. And when there's great anticipation, obviously, it's the end of the Skywalker saga that started in 1977, which in the last, you know, 40 some years, people have almost taken on as a religion. Fans have become so obsessed. They've become so a part of this. They feel an ownership of those characters and that story. And when movies in this movie franchise have not gone their way, they have, while they've gone to see them, and these movies have all made tremendous amounts of money, but a lot of fans are very disappointed, and they're saying, oh, well, this betrayed that, and this betrayed that. And that's not the way this should have happened. And in the past, that's where it would have stayed. But now, because the price of these movies are going up in terms of the production, and so there's a greater pressure to make money and make profit on what you spent, the studios are now beginning to listen to the fans and deliver what the fans want rather than offer a creative vision by the artist, allowing the artist to fulfill their creative vision. And as I said, I think when fans get into it, that's part of the greatest art we have are the endings or the realities of what we don't expect. It's the surprise. It's the contrarian view that an artist gives us that we never would have thought of that makes that artist unique and which makes that art compelling and captivating because it doesn't go the way we expect it. The Mona Lisa isn't smiling from ear to ear. That's what makes it so special centuries later. If fans had their way, would they have killed Vito Corleone in the first Godfather when there were two more films, or would they have kept him alive till the third one? I think they would have kept him alive, right? They would have wanted Marlon Brando to be around, but no. Mario Puzo's creative version was to kill Vito Corleone, to have him die. It was his son's story, Michael's story. But fans loved Vito Corleone. And even if it was Michael's story, if we would have had fan service in 1972, I guarantee you Vito Corleone wouldn't have died. If we would have had fan service in 1939, I bet you Dorothy doesn't click her heels three times and go back to Kansas. I bet you Dorothy stays in Oz because that's where we want Dorothy to be. Right? Won't fans want Dorothy to stay in Oz and see more of the Tin Man? Why go back to Kansas? We want more Tin Man. We want more Scarecrow. We want more Wicked Witch. We want more Munchkins. If we had fan service, would E.T. have gone home? Probably not. They probably would have built them an apartment in the basement or a guest house somewhere. They wouldn't have let E.T. go home. We want more E.T., not less. So that's what's at stake here. So with the release of The Rise of Skywalker, there was a lot of controversy when the film came out. Because critics looked at it from a very objective view and said, well, there's not really a lot here. There's a lot of what fans want. There's a lot of explosions. There's a lot of the characters, you know, getting together, but it's not really going anywhere. There's too much here because they're trying to appeal to everyone. In their effort to appeal to everyone, they don't appeal to anyone. And even diehard fans who went to see the movie and maybe gave it the benefit of the doubt and said they liked it, but many of them were still on the fence. They made clear what they wanted to happen. They may have gotten the movie that they thought they wanted, but when it was on the screen, they didn't like it. And you know why? Because the average fan is not a movie fan. The average fan is not a storyteller. The average fan is not a creative writer. By allowing the fans to dictate from the conceptual standpoint of what something's going to be, we're basically diluting or even rejecting the importance of the artist who created these things. There's always been critics. There's always been people to help the artist. But not when they are ordered to do something. In the case of The Rise of Skywalker, this movie was a complete reaction to the eighth film in the Star Wars franchise, the one that preceded this one, called The Last Jedi. It kind of changed the narrative, it changed the characters, it changed what really Star Wars movies were all about. There was a dark and brooding Luke Skywalker. There was not the camaraderie of all the characters. It just, for many fans, The Last Jedi did not feel like a Star Wars movie, to the point where fans were saying, everything that we've invested ourselves in these characters in these movies has been proven in this movie, The Last Jedi, the eighth one, to not even count, to not even care about. And while the movie made a lot of money, a lot of diehard fans did not like that movie. And so when the final episode was being conceived, it was very clear, not only from what you see on the screen now of what the film became, The Rise of Skywalker, but you were hearing stories already about how the movie was going to bring back what the fans loved about Star Wars. That maybe, yes, maybe that eighth film was kind of a detour that was a wrong detour, but we're gonna, don't worry, fans, we're gonna give you what you want. Fan service. And in doing that, they made an average film. They made an okay film. In an effort to serve the fans, they disserved them because they listened to the fans. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, there's some movies or some TV shows that go ahead, give the fans what they want. Romantic comedies, yes. You know that the unlikely pair will get together and kiss in the rainstorm at the end. That's fine. That's harmless entertainment. You know those Lifetime Christmas movies? Yes. Give the fans what they want. No problem there. That's what those are made for. But when we're talking about some ambitious, unique, creative projects that started that way at least, like a Game of Thrones, like a Star Wars, for the fans to dictate what happens to characters, or for the fans to dictate what happens to storylines, is almost a affront to creativity. It's an affront to art, to the artist. As I said before, it's the audience's job to experience the art and then to either accept it or dismiss it, but not have a hand in creating it. That's what makes the individual artist so special. I mean, some people could have said of Monet, well, I mean, I can't really make anything out here. Why don't you make things more definite? Well, that's that goes against the rules of Impressionism, which made Monet the great artist, of not doing it the way you'd expect it. Or telling Van Gogh not to, well, you know, these colors are too prominent. Don't use your brush so hard. It's not the way we do it. No, that's the way he did it. That's what makes him so special. That's when you look at a Monet painting, you could tell right away it's a Monet painting. When you look right away, you can tell it's a Van Gogh painting. When you watch The Godfather, you were in for some surprises. They may not be what you want, but you never forget them. What are we doing to the artistic process? What are we doing to the artist when we take away the artist's vision and say, well, it's got to go this way? So oftentimes, whenever that happens, whenever an outside source comes in, it always ruins the art. A perfect example of that is a film that came out in the 80s called Once Upon a Time in America. It was a sprawling kind of a gangster film that coincided with the immigrant story of the United States. It was a huge film, big film, in its original version, which is like almost 4 hours long. And the studio said, well, we can't have a 3.5 or 4 hour movie here. This is outrageous. And so they demanded it be cut down to 2 hours or even shorter than that. And it took out the artistic moments of the film that were so powerful, so much so that the great critic Gene Siskel, in reviewing the movie at the end of the year, said the best movie of the year was the original director's version of Once Upon a Time in America that was 4 hours long, and the worst movie of the year was the edited studio's version. That just goes to show you how art can be ruined when the artistic people are not allowed to have their vision. So this idea of fan service is scaring me because it's cropping up more. And when you hear fans talk, they now are expecting it. They are demanding it. I saw people being interviewed when the new movie came out, and there were people at the theaters, and they interviewed one young woman, and she said, well, I expect this movie to be fan service. It better be fan service because I want this to be the way I want it. And she referenced the previous film, The Last Jedi. You know, that movie was very disappointing, and I want this movie to be fan service. And that's what's scary. You know, we're already giving in to people, you know, changing things because, well, this is what they demand. We cannot let that go on in art. The fan does not deserve the right to dictate what happens in a piece of art. The Mona Lisa's smile would have been different. Vito Corleone would have lived. Dorothy would have stayed in Oz. E.T. would have stayed home, would not have gone home. But that's every one of those instances, the opposite happened, and that's what made those movies great. Fan service is, you're going to hear this term more. I'm hoping that after the monetary failure, because the film of The Rise of Skywalker has made hundreds of millions of dollars and may, you know, go on to break some records. It hasn't made as much as they were expecting, and it's not the number one movie of all time, and it probably won't get there, which even though it's making several hundreds of millions of dollars, it should be the number one movie of all time when you think about the impact that Star Wars has had over the last 40 years. But the fact that it hasn't made that much, or may not make that much, also goes that even though people are going to see it out of obligation because they're great Star Wars fans, maybe they're not seeing it 7 or 8 times like they should if they really liked it. So that's my point here. There's been such a backlash, and the term now fan service is being applied right to this film. It almost feels as if there was a definite kind of acquiescing to the fans at the conceptual part, not in the editing or in the tinkering of it, the tweaking at the end, but at the very beginning. We have to make a movie that's going to please the fans. Even if the story and the characters had been moving in a different direction, it appears as if the directive from the top was, well, then let's pretend that movie never even existed and just do what the fans want. And ironically, by doing what the fans want, they created a film that wasn't as good and did not even please the fans, because Star Wars fans are impossible to please anyway. And maybe Disney learned that lesson. It's sad that they had to learn the lesson at the expense of the final chapter of, you know, a pop culture icon like the Star Wars story. But they did. And so I think we need to put the brakes on this fan service stuff, because fans don't have the creative and artistic vision, and they shouldn't. They're not expected to. They're expected to be entertained. They're expected to react. They're expected to accept or dismiss, but they are not expected to create. And not only are they not expected to create, they're not capable of creating. That's why we have artists. That's why they're unique. Let's not destroy the creative process. Let's not curtail the artist. Let's not get the expected ending. Let's get the ending that we never saw coming. That's what makes great art. Let's serve the artist. Let's not serve the fan. Does the fan have a right to demand that? Now, for instance, in my situation, I'm a fan of Elton John. I'm a fan of Bruce Springsteen, as two that I'll just throw out there. But I am not above criticizing them for what some things that they've done in their art. I don't love every album that they've put out. I don't agree with every artistic decision they've made. That doesn't mean that I have a right to tell them what or what not to do. I have a right to experience their art, what they offer me, and then like it or not. Nobody will like anything that they do as much as I do. When I think it's good, I will give it the most flowery and adjectives that are, you know, over the top if I think it's something amazing and great. But similarly, if they do something that I don't think is good, I will be just as hard on them. That's my job. That's my role as a fan. I can't dictate what they do. I can hope what they would do. But ultimately, it's their vision, and I respect them as artists to do that. And because they are human, they will fail. But I also, and they may go into places that a fan objectively can look at an artist and say they are never good. That's never going to be good. They can't do that. And sure enough, it isn't good. But the artist has to go where their art and their talent and their vision takes them, whether it's commercially viable or not, because that's a true artist. The fan is, as I said before, about selfishness. The fan is selfish. They want what they want about it. But, you know, it's my creation. If I'm the artist, and this is where I see it going. And as I said, the main reason that the audience embraced it was because of those initial decisions that the artist made before you even knew it existed. When George Lucas created Darth Vader, he had some artistic views and visions in mind, and you embraced that. And then you wanted to take it away from George Lucas. That's not your right as a fan. That's not your right as a fan. He created it. Initially, before you even knew it existed. Why do you now gain, all of a sudden demand ownership of it? It's his. If it doesn't end the way you like it, that's too bad. You have a right to say you didn't like it, but you don't have a right to change it. On the other side of a coin, I'd like to know what a fan is. So I'd love to you can go on my Facebook page. We can't obviously go back and forth here, but if you have any opinions when I post this on my Facebook page, please feel free, because I'd love to know what your view is a fan. Are you a blind fan? Are you a critical fan? What does it mean to be a fan? What rights does a fan have? And I bring this up because recently I'm also been questioning what it is to be not only a fan of art and creative things, which I think fans are getting way too much power in with this idea of fan service. But then I look to the sporting world and I realize that fans are not exerting their power. The irony is in the entertainment world, they're exerting their power and it's having adverse effects. And in the sporting world, the fans are not exerting their power and it's having adverse effects. And I bring this up because I'm from Chicago, and at the beginning of this season, I predicted that the Chicago Bears would be at best 8-8 and probably 9-7 or 7-9, having a losing record, even though almost everybody in this city, fans, media, everybody was predicting the Bears are going to win the Super Bowl because they were 12-4 last year and had a dominating defense. However, when I was watching the games, I saw a team that the offense was not scoring a lot of points. The defense was either scoring the points or creating opportunities for the offense to score very easily. And so I saw a team that was getting very lucky and getting a lot of breaks. And I saw a team that didn't really have a very good offense, that if it wasn't for that defense, they weren't a 12-4 team. And then they lost their defensive coordinator, who went to another team to be a head coach. And I said, well, that's a major loss. But no one seemed to really care about that. It's almost, you know, once again, kind of dismissing the talent of the defensive coordinator. The same way I said before about fan service dismissing the importance of the artist. No one even mentioned, well, we lost the defensive coordinator. Well, he's the guy that calls the plays. So you're basically saying you don't really need a coach. As long as you have the players, the coach doesn't really matter. Well, I thought the coach did matter. Once again, I'm on the side of the artist. I also knew that the team was going to have a tougher schedule because now they came in first place in the league. You get a tougher schedule based on your standings the year before. So putting those all together, I said I thought that the Bears were an average team last year, even though their record was 12-4. I felt that they lost a major component of the thing that made them that good, which was their defensive coordinator, and they were also going to be playing now better teams. They weren't going to play a last place schedule, which they played last year to get that 12-4 record. So I said, I hate to break to pop your balloon, Bear fans, but 7-9, at best 8-8. Well, I was, you know, by friends and even people, you know, out in the world, because I put this on my Facebook page, I was called a disloyal fan, or I was called not a fan, because I dared to say the Bears wouldn't make the playoffs. There's my question to you then. What is the role of a fan? My view of a fan is to be someone who follows the team and hopes that they win. And in the way the Bears have been run for the last 34 years since they've won a Super Bowl, they have not been run very well. They have not won a Super Bowl in 34 years since January of 1986. This will be the 34th year. And so I have to question how the team is run, because they haven't won. To me, winning and losing is the determining factor. Are you a blind faith fan? Is that what it means to be a fan? That, especially in sports, that you, it doesn't matter if the team wins or loses, you're just there to support them? And that's when you go 108 years like the Cub fans did before a championship? Or do you demand that through your fandom that the team deliver a winning team by making better decisions from the ownership on down? I get it. In Chicago, being a Bear fan is like a religion. It is a birthright. It is a part of the fabric of people's families or friendships. They are born into the Bear fandom. They have weekly get-togethers. It's a social occasion even more than it is a sporting occasion. Everybody wears their jerseys and hats and their t-shirts, and they get together as a family or friends, and they go to a bar, or they go to somebody's house, and they have the weekly favorite Bear appetizer or food. I understand it. I get it. That kind of loyalty and that kind of devotion is admirable. I admire it. I don't share it, but I admire it. Because as I said before, even though I'm a fan, I seem to look at things more objectively than completely subjectively. I'm always leery of blind faith. And Bear fans have the power to either continue to let this history of losing continue by being blindly loyal to them, by allowing the team to just be okay every year and starting off the season with all this great optimism and then being disappointed. And then the next year, instead of doing something about it, the fans just fall right back in and say, oh, the Bears are going to win this year. And 35 years later, they haven't won. That's the grade. In a sporting thing, I believe you are graded on if you win or not, or at least you get into the finals. That's the way the successful sporting franchises are. They don't expect to just be in first place. They expect to get to the World Series or the Super Bowl. They may win or lose it, but they expect to be there. To me, that is how you judge yourself. Bear fans are happy to just get to the playoffs, and if they lose in the first round, we'll get them next year. Because so much of this socialization depends on that. But just think how great it was. Remember how great it was when they were the best team in football. Remember how fun that was? Don't you want that to happen again? There's people now that are 30 years old that don't even remember the last Bears Super Bowl. You remember how fun that season was? I do. And for this, in the seasons after, while they were still good, they weren't great, they still had a shot. They haven't had a shot in 15 years. They have not been good in almost 20 years, to be honest. But Bear fans keep going. They keep buying the hats. They keep buying the jerseys. They keep watching the games. They keep buying the tickets. Movie fans show their displeasure and have gotten results. Now, you can argue about the results, but it's a different animal as well. In sports, there's winning and losing, and there's ways to win and there's ways to lose. The Bears ownership has followed the same script for 35 years, and they keep getting the same result. It's no surprise. Ask any physicist. You put in the same, or any scientist, you put in the same components, you'll get the same result. All the fan and media optimism in the world can't change the reality. Bad ingredients, bad result. And that's been the script that the Bear ownership has done for the last 35 years, because they know the fans will not rebel. Bear fans, do you want the team to be good, or do you just want them to play games? If you just want them to play games, if you just want them to show up just so you can have a social gathering, then fine. If that's your goal, if that's your end game, and winning is just gravy, and if it happens, it happens. But if it doesn't, it's no big deal, because I still want to wear I still am a fan, then that's fine. But are you really doing a service to your team by being that kind of fan? I am a fan. I want the Bears to be good. That's why I'm critical of them. A lot of fans can't understand my viewpoint. No, well, you're not a fan if you don't like them. No. I am just as big a fan as you are, but my goal is that they continue to be good, not just exist. When I criticize Elton John or Bruce Springsteen, it's not because I hate them. I want them to do better. I think they're capable of more, of better. I think the Bears are capable of better. I don't think Bear fans demand that of them. I wish Bear fans were more like Chicago Blackhawk fans. Chicago Blackhawk fans, for about 10 years, are the role model for making a team stand up and notice and do things right and ultimately win. If you're a Bear fan, look at the Blackhawks. See what they did. Their fans played just as much of a role in the turnaround of that team than anything else, because the fans did something that was very difficult for them to do. Blackhawk fans are among the most passionate and knowledgeable and devoted sports fans in all of sports. But they also realized that they were not going to be made fools of anymore. And the previous ownership was not respecting the fans on many levels. And when the old owner died and his son took over, rather than just following in his father's footsteps, he realized, as much as he loved his father, Rocky Wirtz, he realized his father had not managed the team correctly. And rather than continuing his father's horrible policies, he changed every one of them. The result, and he changed them because the fans stayed away. There was a 20,000-seat stadium, and there was 5,000 people at each game, and half of those people were from other cities for the other team. Blackhawk fans said, we are not supporting this team until it changes. And when it changed, within 2 years, they won a Stanley Cup. And in within 10 years, they won three Stanley Cups. Three championships. Because the fans stood up and rebelled and said, we've had enough. Cub fans, why do you think you waited 108 years for that? Because you never stopped supporting them. You never stopped going to games. You never stopped buying the hats and the jerseys because it had become, as I said, this birthright with people. And with Bear fans, it's even more because there's only 16 games, so every game is an event. I know it's hard. I know you'll have to find something different to do on Sunday. I understand it will be breaking tradition. I get all of that. But do you want the Bears to be good? Your role of as a fan should to be demanding excellence and demanding winning and demanding championships. And by you continuing to blindly follow this team by buying the tickets, by buying the shirts, by getting together and going to the bars, to creating that economic engine, whether that is printing up money, whether they win or lose, you are not sending a message to the ownership that they need to right their ship. I hope after this disastrous season this year that fans, Bear fans, are hopefully, after having their expectations at the beginning of the season completely dashed, I hope finally, after more than three decades, that Bear fans will finally wake up and say, we're mad as hell, we're not going to take it anymore. I don't think it's going to happen, but I pray it does, because until the fans stop going, until the fans stop buying the shirts, until they stop watching it on television, before they stop going to games, this isn't going to happen. Now that's fan service. Make the team serve you. In sports, fan service is good. If the fans revolt. In the entertainment world, fan service, I think, is dangerous. But in the terms of fan service, meaning deliver the fans a champion, that is fan service. The Bears are not providing fan service. Bear fans, they are disrespecting you. And they have disrespected you for the last three decades. Do what Blackhawk fans did. And maybe you would have three Super Bowl rings in this next decade. I'm saying this now because a new decade is starting. As I said in the last podcast, we have an open canvas here. Let's not have the 2020s be the same disastrous, horribly losing decade that the 2010s were. And I do blame, in many ways, the Bear fans for not rebelling. Let's start this decade by the fans taking control back and telling the Bear ownership that they need to change their ways or we're not coming anymore. And use the Blackhawks fans as an example because they have three Stanley Cups in the last 10 years. The Bears have nothing in the last 10 years and nothing in the last 30 years. So which way is right and which way is wrong? But what is it to be a fan? You tell me. I believe being a fan is having a great admiration and enthusiasm and passion for something and wanting it to be the best it can be. And if that means criticizing it, then that means criticizing it to get it to that point. I think I am as just an obsessed and passionate and loyal fan by criticizing my object of fandom as I am praising it. Some people think that's being a traitor. I believe it's trying to help it be the best it can be. Blind faith doesn't work. Especially when it comes to sports. I have to have some little blind faith in the artistic side. I'll allow that to happen. It's different. There's no end game. There's no winner or loser here. It's all interpretation. So that's why the artist gets more of a leeway than the sports team. And that's why the fans' role is different, I believe. But at the end of the day, the fans should always be passionate, should always be loyal and devoted, but also want the best for it. And in some ways, that means the fans hold off in terms of fan service for TV or movies because we're not the creators. But in sports, it means we're much more active in criticizing because there is a definite way to decide a winner or a loser. The score. So what's a fan? You tell me. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNplus.com or is available wherever you download your favorite podcasts. So don't forget to subscribe, rate, and pass on to your friends that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Your devotion and your loyalty is much, much appreciated. Welcome, and I hope you enjoyed episode 189. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. This has been Captain Podtastic, the only podcast from the end of the web to your screen.